Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I am John Iadarola, and this is just too big of a show. It's packed full. We're not going to get to everything, but I wish that we could because it's all important. Throughout this hour, we're going to talk about a fairly big development in the Democratic primary that is in its early stages right now. But I think this is actually going to be a big narrative throughout it, which we'll be breaking down. A little bit later on, a couple of freshman congresswomen being attacked for a number of different reasons. We're going to talk about why both Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are innocent on the charges being presented against them. Some from the left, some from the right. I'm going to talk about both of those. We'll be closing out the show with Meanwhile In, news updates from around the world. And along the way, we've got two awesome guests who are going to be joining us. So just in a little bit, David K. Johnston, investigative journalist, is going to be joining us again on the show to break down the latest developments in Donald Trump's ongoing saga, including reactions to last week's Michael Cohen testimony, the new investigations that the House is launching, and the enduring quest for Donald Trump's taxes. Later on, Jamelia Land is going to be joining us, close family friend of Stephon Clark's family, to respond to the developments that we talked about on yesterday's show, which were certainly disappointing in that totally needless tragedy of a killing. So why don't we jump into the domestic news first? Big news for the Democratic primary, Hillary Clinton will not be running again. She said this, talking with a New York television station, "I'm not running, but I'm going to keep working on and speaking and standing up for what I believe." So that is fairly clear, fairly unambiguous. Small caveat, and I don't think that it actually applies here. I'm just putting it out there. There is nothing in the world that people lie about more than that they're not running for president or for whatever. The reason being that it literally doesn't matter if you lie about it. If you say, "I'm not running," and then it turns out that you are, nobody cares. What's the difference? So people lie a ton. But I think that she's probably being honest here. And she goes more in depth into what she will be doing during this primary. She is not going back into the woods or anything like that. She says, "I'm not going anywhere. What's at stake in our country, the kind of things that are happening right now, are deeply troubling to me. And I'm also thinking hard about how do we start talking and listening to each other again. We've just gotten so polarized. We've gotten into really opposing camps, unlike anything I've ever seen in my adult life." So I agree with her there. And it's interesting. She sounds very similar to another politician, which we're going to return to in just a few minutes. The issue is that while I totally agree with her evaluation of where we are as a country and inside of the Democratic Party and inside of the left, many of the people who support her the most at the highest levels, former aides and campaign managers and activists and all that who were big Hillary fans back in 2016, they don't appear to have gotten this memo, and they have started off this campaign aggressively attacking Bernie Sanders. I would say other candidates, but it's mainly Bernie Sanders. We'll see if they diversify a bit. But let's talk about just a little bit of this. So Nick Morrell, who'd worked with Hillary Clinton, had been responding to a question on The View that Bernie Sanders faced, which was, would he ask Hillary Clinton for advice on the campaign trail? So this was asked by Meghan McCain, bear that in mind. And Nick Morrell responded to Bernie Sanders' response, which was, "No, I don't think I'll be doing that," saying, "I don't know who our nominee is going to be, but I am damn sure that beating Trump and getting America back on the right footing is going to require a unified Democratic Party. So stuff like this, 613 days before Election Day, is irresponsible, counterproductive, and sets us all back," saying that Bernie Sanders saying that he would not be asking Hillary Clinton for campaign advice is divisive. Okay, well, I will let you rate that against some of the other divisive things which we're going to cover. But bear in mind, this question was not asked by the leftist on the panel, if there is one. It was Meghan McCain. Meghan McCain asked this question specifically to try to create division. And so this guy, who is still a gigantic fan of Hillary Clinton, I understand Hillary Clinton has a lot of fans, a lot of people who really like her, a lot of people love her and really wish that she was president. I wish that she was president right now because we are living in a waking nightmare. But he is helping Meghan McCain to try to hurt the Democratic Party. That is what she is trying to do. Create division. It's not like she's just concerned about Bernie because she wants what's best for the Democratic Party. And they are playing into this. And it's not just this guy. So Politico, maybe accidentally, doesn't really seem like it, has been on a tear against progressives recently. So we broke down and threw them into the trash over their articles, their really dishonest articles about Namiki Konst, who had been running as New York City's public advocate. We had the ex-Clinton staffers slam Sanders over private jet flights, leaving out the fact, of course, that those private jet flights were literally to fly around the country doing events to get Hillary Clinton elected in the weeks and months leading up to the election. So they had that. They have another one. Clinton camp stews over Sanders' 2020 campaign, which is basically just, hey, anybody who worked for Hillary Clinton, just come on here and complain about Bernie Sanders. They just collected a bunch of that stuff. And so I'm going to go out on a limb. This is a bold prediction. We can expect a lot of this through the course of this primary, where Politico apparently believes that while there is like 75 different people running in this primary, they're going to talk about one of them. And not in a proactive, let's push our agenda sort of way, just a, we got to take this guy down. And we will allow anyone who has any sour grapes about the 2016 campaign to come on to help do it. And so self-defeatingly at times. So this is from the Politico piece. When Sanders pulled in $1 million in the first 3.5 hours of his campaign, Adam Parkomenko, the former director of grassroots engagement for the 2016 Clinton campaign, tweeted, "Only half were named Vladimir." Like, this is a cliche at this point. Like, first of all, I like to think that I have an especial amount of credibility in talking about this issue because I acknowledge and am worried about Russian interference in the election. But they're not supporting Bernie Sanders. That is insane. He has a very real chance, if he's the nominee, of taking down Donald Trump. Like, you got some signals crossed there, and you just want to say, I don't like him, so obviously he must be supported by the people who support the other people that I don't like. Damn the logic. Who cares at that point? You had, after Sanders' first rally this weekend, former Clinton campaign aide Zerlina Maxwell claimed on MSNBC that Sanders, quote, did not mention race or gender until 23 minutes into his speech. She later walked back her comments after critics, including former Sanders campaign staffer Waleed Shahid, noted that Sanders talked about racism and sexism much earlier in the event, literally just minutes into it. And she was watching and doing live analysis, but it plays into a narrative, so ignore the things they said in a speech that was predominantly about those issues because it helps to advance that narrative. But I want to return to, I said in the beginning, Hillary Clinton actually sounds like another politician. That politician is Bernie Sanders in this case, because he sent an email just a couple of weeks ago to his supporters saying, as we engage with our opponents in the Democratic primary, we will forcefully present our views and defend ourselves against misrepresentations. But let us do our very best to engage respectfully with our Democratic opponents, talking about the issues we are fighting for, not about personalities or past grievances. I want to be clear that I condemn bullying and harassment of any kind and in any space. And I could not agree more with that statement. And I hope so much that that is how we go through this Democratic primary, because Bernie doesn't want to relitigate the 2016 primary. Hillary says she doesn't want to relitigate the 2016 primary, but her staffers, they sure seem to want to do that. And just because Hillary is not running in this campaign does not mean that we are not going to have shades of 2016. I don't expect that those people watch the show, and they're certainly not going to listen to me. But anyone who does, please go through this process in the way that Bernie Sanders wants us to, respectfully disagreeing on the policy, what actually matters, pushing what we believe needs to happen in terms of pursuing our values and pushing for policies that will help the American people and America more generally. That is what we need. Politico is going to be on the opposite side of this, but we don't need to make both sides in this any easier of a case to be made. With that, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, David K. Johnson is going to be joining us to talk about Michael Cohen, Donald Trump, and more after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Damage Damage Report, everybody. I want to turn now to some of the attacks that have been levied against two of the newest congresswomen. First, starting with Ilhan Omar. If you've been following the news, you know that Ilhan Omar, the consensus appears to be that she is literally the most controversial person in D.C. right now. And so she is facing attacks from both Democrats and Republicans over comments that she has made. This is, to some extent, a repeat of a conversation that we had in January that we're now having. And tomorrow, supposedly, the House is going to be voting on a resolution to condemn what she has said. And so the resolution, which began circulating to members Monday night, comes after a backlash from top Democrats who accused Omar of anti-Semitism for referring to pro-Israel advocates, quote, allegiance to a foreign country. Now, look, should she have used that particular terminology? No, I don't believe that she should have. It is a trope going back, the idea that in America, people who are Jewish have dual loyalties, that they are loyal to America, but they're also loyal to Israel. It's a way to question what they do. That is true. Is that what she was intending to do? I don't know. I'm inclined to believe not, but I also understand that persuading you of that would be literally impossible, so we're going to move on. In any event, she certainly should not have used that language. However, people are attempting to say that this is obvious anti-Semitism. This is not misspeaking. This is not, she should have worded that differently. This is not, well, this is a learning moment. This is, she is to her core an anti-Semite, and we need the full U.S. government to condemn her. Now, look, if I wanted to, I could go through a long list of other people who very recently have said things that are incredibly questionable that nobody seems to care about. So Jim Jordan with his Tom Steyer, where he replaced the S with a dollar sign saying that he was calling the shots for the Democratic Party. I don't know why that's not in this conversation, but fine. I want to talk about her in particular. So I've already said I believe she should have worded it differently. However, far more importantly is what she was actually trying to talk about, and it is that beyond our relationship with any other country, including our chief economic partners in Europe and all of that, there is a belief that you cannot ever question any individual policy component of the relationship between the U.S. and with Israel, and that if Israel's government, regardless of which party is in power, the individual leadership of that particular party, if they say a thing, then to question it is to question Israel as a country and Judaism as a religion. Now, this is not we don't do this to any other country, but we do it traditionally with Israel. She is attempting to add a little bit of nuance and say, we can start to question some of these things. And inside of the U.S., perhaps, as we question every other lobby that has outsized influence over political outcomes here, we can question AIPAC, for instance. But that is apparently not the case. Now, generally, the attacks against her have said, you cannot say these things in a way that either is or can reasonably be interpreted to be anti-Semitic or to have anti-Semitic sort of connotations. But some go farther than that. So Representative Juan Vargas said, it is disturbing that Representative Omar continues to perpetuate hurtful anti-Semitic stereotypes that misrepresent our Jewish community. Additionally, questioning support for the U.S.-Israel relationship is unacceptable. Well, look, as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez responds there, I'm curious if Representative Vargas will further explain his stance here that it's unacceptable to even question U.S. foreign policy. That is a big step past. So you're saying that literally any question whatsoever about the bounds or terms or future or anything of the particular relationship between our country and another question is unacceptable and should be condemned by Congress. I don't believe that the vast majority of even the people who are attacking Ilhan Omar would actually say that, but he has. And so perhaps he will finesse that a little bit in the future. I don't understand what he's trying to get at there. My point more largely, though, is Ilhan Omar is receiving scorn for the thing that she said, but that isn't necessarily why it is happening or why it merits congressional condemnation. I believe that it is much more about who she is and what she represents. Now, obviously, for those on the right, the simple fact that a woman wearing a hijab can sit in government at all for 1 second is a campaign that will need to be waged to stop her, get her out of office, and make sure that it never happens again. That is very clear. And when they get that message across, there's very little condemnation, certainly nothing like what she is facing here. So look at this poster. So I believe it was the West Virginia Republican Party had this poster up. Never forget, you said, a picture of Ilhan Omar, I am the proof you have forgotten. So that, there's nothing there about a comment she's made. There's nothing there about anti-Semitism. It is simply, she is a Muslim woman. So how dare America allow her to sit in office? West Virginia Republican Party. Are they being condemned over that? Over just obvious anti-Semitism? No policy implications, no nuance or question of exactly what they meant. We know exactly what they meant. And there's more to it. So Jeff Balaban, Trump for President advisor, said in regards to her, I'm going to say it, she is filth. She is a filthy, disgusting hater. I believe that was with Stuart Varney. So that's on Fox Business, I believe it was. Just calling her filth. Now, where have you heard that sort of phrasing for people from that part of the world before? And yet, that's what they did. So Imran Siddiqui tweeted out an article that the Washington Post had. Ilhan Omar is the Steve King of the left, by Henry Olson. Steve King is an out-and-out white nationalist. He doesn't even understand why being a white supremacist should even be offensive. He said that very clearly. And yet, this guy is saying, this Somali immigrant who somehow became an elected official, an impossible dream story for America, she is the same thing as an out-and-out white supremacist. So understand the context that this condemnation comes in. That certain types of clear, unambiguous Islamophobia is 100% okay. Don't question it. Put it in the Washington Post. Put it in the halls of the West Virginia Republican Party. Totally fine. Don't even worry about it. But in this case, where we could have a conversation about what she means and how it can be best expressed, legitimate concerns about money and politics and all of that, no, there's no room for ambiguity in that. There's more that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went into about how we don't seem to have the same standard for homophobic comments, misogynistic comments. If you attack African-Americans, totally fine, no condemnation, you'll be totally okay. It's just in this one area. And by the way, the point she was making was that these lobbies have a lot of influence. And I guess the counterpoint is that that's unacceptable, and that's not true. And so it's odd that in the wake of what she said, Stephen Fisk, who's a longtime activist for AIPAC, said of Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Ilhan Omar, they are three people who, in my opinion, will not be around in several years. If you're fighting against the idea that your lobby has a lot of power, claiming that you are able to predict that these three representatives in totally different parts of the country are all going to be taken out because they turned against this lobby or are perceived to have, that undercuts the argument just a little bit from my point of view. Okay, I want to move on to something slightly lighter, and that is attacks against AOC for purported hypocrisy on the Green New Deal continue, and they're getting even more ridiculous as time passes. So New York Post had this, gas-guzzling car ride exposes AOC's hypocrisy amid Green New Deal pledge. So if you are advocating for more electric vehicles and public transportation, and you ever step foot in a Corolla, God help you, we're going to take you down, AOC. That seems weird. But remember, we talked about something last week. It was Caleb Hull who took a weird creep shot of her and her chief of staff eating hamburgers. Let's bring that up. Stalking her in restaurants and saying that because I believe that you're going to ban hamburgers. You're not. It's not in there. But I believe it. If I see you in In-N-Out, we're going to take you down, is obviously ridiculous as well. Jordan Yule, who's a friend of the show, said, breaking news, AOC caught exhaling carbon dioxide more at 6 or something like that. And it's ridiculous. Again, they could if they wanted to. If you're not an environmentalist, if you don't believe in the Green New Deal, if you're a climate denier, a climate delayer, or whatever, you could argue against the policy on the merits and say, well, I have a plan that lowers air pollution because I care about that at the very least and stimulates economic activity, and I believe it's better than the Green New Deal. They could do that. They are choosing not to do that. They are spreading ridiculous, obviously false things in an attempt to make her seem crazy, a trope that they turn back to time and time again. Spreading conspiracy theories, the fact that Donald Trump has so eagerly jumped onto these things should be a sign that perhaps the facts are not behind them. So anyone who's adding on to this, understand who your allies are in this fight. Now, she takes things in stride. She responds in a very funny way, saying, according to GOP, when poor and working people advocate for themselves, we shouldn't listen because they're irresponsible. Yet when higher incomes fight for working people, we shouldn't listen because they're hypocrites. How about we fight for the right thing because it's the right thing? And I think she's proving that there is a big appetite in this country for people who choose to do that. She also said, she had a picture on Twitter saying, I need to admit something to you all. Frankly, I don't know how my environmental reputation can recover. Today, I wrote in a book made out of paper. Apparently, using present technology means I can't fight for new jobs, investing in infrastructure and renewable energy. I pointed out perhaps she should have used a tablet, but people responded saying that would be a waste of electricity. She also got called out for taking a van somewhere. She says, I will have you know my Tia was very upset that the New York Post insulted her minivan. She's riding around with her family. Can we get it together as a country, please, people, and argue on the merits? If you don't believe that climate change is happening, or if you don't think the Green New Deal is the way to address it, say that. Lay out a plan. Talk to some scientists, okay? That attacking her for every food choice, I mean, God knows what fibers or clothes are made out of. They're going to be on that next. She once patted a pig, and she says we shouldn't eat so many. I don't know where they're going to go next. But I do want to say she understands why she is being targeted in this particular way. In a great quote, "The idea that a woman could be as powerful as a man is something that our society can't deal with. But I am as powerful as a man, and it drives them crazy." Like, when I first read that, it almost made me tear up in that interview because it is so powerful and so true. It doesn't mean that if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was Alex Ocasio-Cortez, they wouldn't oppose him, but it would come from a very different perspective. The ferocity of it would not be there in the same way, and that is, I think, so clear. Now, very fast, I just want to play one video of why she responds to these things, because some politicians don't. They think we should be super hands-off, don't engage. She doesn't think so, and here's what she said about that.
I grew up seeing these attacks on Nancy Pelosi. I grew up with these attacks on Barack Obama. I grew up with these bad faith attacks even on Hillary Clinton. And so we know what's going on. And I feel like what I've chosen to do is break this fourth wall a little bit and respond to them. Because we saw how completely unfounded attacks like the birther movement with President Obama, they were ignored because it was beneath the president to respond to these things. But then they started to grow, and as we say, they grow legs and start walking around. And I think that sometimes we have to take a little bit of a different tack and just squash it early and respond to them and be unafraid to say, you sound ridiculous.
Yeah. And look, that strategy could backfire if she wasn't as adept at dealing with these things as she is. But I totally agree. We saw, I mean, throughout Obama's terms, the crazy conspiracy theories. And then, you know, during the 2016 election as well, the idea that Hillary Clinton was stalking the streets of D.C. and murdering people who were leaking stuff about her, and that she, you know, did you know that she died 2 years ago from Parkinson's and all that? These conspiracy theories need to be nipped in the bud ASAP before people start to spread them, and they become just the common accepted wisdom amongst a large percentage of the American population. So I totally agree with AOC on that point. Now, we do have to take a break. We come back, lots more to get to. Stick around. This year is going to be bad for Donald Trump. And joining us now to break down why this last week was bad for Donald Trump is David K. Johnson, investigative journalist. David, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you, John.
Very glad to have you here. So there's a lot that I would love to talk about, but I am curious to get your impressions of last week's Michael Cohen hearings. How significant do you think they are in light of everything else that we know and have experienced in this issue?
Well, on the one hand, other than the $35,000 check, he didn't tell us anything that those of us paying very close attention know. It's very different when the president's lawyer for more than 10 years tells you things, not me, not my colleague Tim O'Brien, but the president's lawyer. And I think the testimony that he gave was a roadmap. I count at least 14 different criminal paths that prosecutors could follow or the committee could follow.
14.
And of course, he's coming back Wednesday of this week, and they'll be doing more testimony, although I'm not sure whether it's behind closed doors or in the open.
I believe that it might be behind closed doors, unfortunately, but maybe some will come out from what he had said. I'm also interested, the questioning from the Republicans during the Michael Cohen hearing, I had expected that they would make a good faith attempt to argue that the president hasn't broken any laws, but they did not seem interested in that. At all. What do you think about that strategy?
I think that it was very clear that they were each playing to their bases. Remember that the red district Republicans have a problem if they want to get reelected. 80% is the lowest approval number I've ever seen among likely Republican voters for anything Donald Trump has done.
Wow.
Now, let me also be clear, if you're holding back and not dealing with the truth because you're afraid you'll get come out in a primary and you'll lose, you're a coward. People died for this country and you're afraid you won't get reelected. You have a constitutional duty of oversight. Republican Congresses have investigated Republican presidents and Democratic Congresses, Democratic presidents. And what you saw Jim Jordan of Ohio in particular leading at that committee is cowardice. And that's what we should call them, cowards.
So one of the quotes from Michael Cohen that worried me the most and didn't get talked about much after the hearing was he said that he fears that if Donald Trump loses in 2020, there will not be a peaceful transfer of power. Obviously, you know a lot about Donald Trump. Do you share that same fear?
Well, when Donald won the Electoral College 2 years ago, I said right away that if Donald could pull it off, he would suspend the Constitution and declare himself effectively emperor, whatever he called the title, because Donald doesn't understand the Constitution. He has no idea what his oath of office is, and he's deeply mentally ill. The good news is there are a number of surveys now of our officer corps, and they don't support Donald Trump. So he's not going to be able to pull off a coup. If Trump is voted out in 2020 and he refuses to leave the White House, I expect the Secret Service will frog march him out of the building.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that would certainly be an image. I would love to see SNL's version of that the following Saturday.
Yes.
So let's turn to another topic, perhaps drawing somewhat from the Michael Cohen hearings and the questioning of people like Ro Khanna and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The House has announced that they are going to be talking to virtually everyone connected to Donald Trump in a significant political and economic fashion. People high up in the Trump organization, lawyers, some who have already been convicted or pled guilty to crimes. This new round of investigations, what was your reaction to that being announced?
Well, this is the Judiciary Committee, and it's the Judiciary Committee under Jerry Nadler, who represents part of Manhattan, that would pursue impeachment, though I don't expect to see Donald Trump tried in the Senate for impeachment, at least certainly not on what we know now. It's a very comprehensive list. Some of these people are going to fight are asserting either executive privilege or attorney-client privilege in the case of Sherry Dillon, Trump's lawyer for his Eyes Wide Open Blind Trust. And there was only one name missing from the 81 people that I thought should be there, and that's Joseph Wechselbaum, who lives in Santa Monica. He is the international cocaine trafficker who Donald was in business with for years. And I've said in the past, and I'll say again now, there is no logical explanation for what Donald did as favors and other dealings with Joseph Wechselbaum unless he was in the cocaine trafficking business with Joe. And Donald, if you're listening, if you think I just slandered you, sue me.
That is a strong statement. Donald, please don't sue me. I don't have a lawyer and I can't afford the retainer. So, you know, it's interesting. You talk about his connection to some really shady figures. And for a long time, I believe you and I have talked about his past ties to the mafia and things like that. It certainly seemed like it's not just historic connections, but that the more we learn about, especially coming from Michael Cohen, it seems like the Trump organization has adapted some sort of mob ways of running things, the constant threats and the secrecy and the hidden orders and things like that. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely, it's a fair assessment. And Donald's dealings are not limited just to mafia-connected people in the New York construction business. If that was the case, you could say, well, they had a hand over this guy. But while other developers went to the FBI and the Justice Department almost 40 years ago and said, you've got to get these guys out of our pockets, Donald did not. Mm-hmm. And when there was a concrete strike in New York and the Teamsters and the Concrete Workers Union were both under the thumb of the Genovese and Gambino crime families, every construction project in New York that used concrete, whether you were just patching your driveway or it was something bigger, stopped, except Trump Tower. And Donald, throughout his life, has dealt with not just traditional mafia in New York, but Russian mobsters, Georgian, as in the country, Georgia mobsters, Kazakh mobsters, Irish mobsters, all sorts of people like that. And he operates as the third generation head of a white-collar crime family. Mm. Let's check the family history. His grandfather, Friedrich, flees the German draft in 1885 when he turned 16, as a lot of young men did, comes to America, lies to get his citizenship, and runs whorehouses. He was a pimp in Washington State and the Yukon Territory. His father, Fred, had a business partner, Willie Tomasello, who was a front for the Genovese and Gambino crime families. And these are not people who go out and break your legs or murder people. These are people who cheat and steal from you by refusing to pay for things and using the court process.
That sounds like his MO there.
And there's in addition to the RICO statutes federally, John, there's a New York State RICO law, which could be applied. So even if Trump somehow could stop the Southern District of New York, Letitia James, the new Attorney General of New York, who's promised to be vigilant and aggressive dealing with Trump can make a case.
You know, I'm curious. I don't know if you saw this morning, but apparently Mitch McConnell has acknowledged that there is likely to be a vote and enough votes to have the Senate block the declaration of a national emergency. And so I'm curious from your point of view, based again on what you know historically about Donald Trump, how do you think he'll react to not just the Democrats, but in this case, some Republicans as well, working to hamstring him a little bit in this particular regard?
Well, you're finally beginning to see some of the Republicans who have principles about what the power of the executive is, and the executive's authority is basically to do whatever Congress has told him to do, separating themselves. And for sure, he will lose this vote in the Senate, but he will veto it. He will denounce the Republicans who voted against him as traitors. He will threaten to raise money to go after them, which is an extraordinary thing for a president of any party to do about members of his own party. And the thing to see will be, are there 67 votes in the Senate to override a veto of this? If the Republicans have any principles at all, they should, because this is not a national emergency. Everything points against it, including Trump's own words.
You know, it's interesting because I too have been looking to see, will we start to see a few elected Republican rats start to flee the ship at some point? But I'm also curious about his base on the one hand. Does that start to slip a little bit? And then his the media arm in Fox News. And I just saw yesterday, I think it was New York Magazine, showed that he still maintains. What's that?
The New Yorker.
The New Yorker, yes, sorry. His loyalty ratings for different hosts. Steve Doocy is still a 12 out of 10, which is pretty amazing. Do you think that we might start to see a little bit of question? Because as of right now, Sean Hannity and all of them still seem they're locked in for Donald Trump.
Well, at the end of the day, Rupert Murdoch is a commercial animal. And if at some point he concludes that the enormous profits that are being turned out by Fox, because looked at as a business, not journalism, it's a really well-run, smart business. If he begins to see that his profits are endangered, then he will issue directives to change the stories, just as he, according to Jane Meyer's story in The New Yorker, killed the story they had about paying off Stormy Daniels. The reporter being told, Rupert wants Donald to win, so sorry, good try, but we're not going to run that story. Among his base, Michael Cohen's testimony on its own is not going to change anything, but we're about to see political drip torture, witness after witness after document. And if the Democrats don't overplay their hand, they focus on what's significant, and they learn not to preen when they ask questions, and they follow the model of Ocasio-Cortez, Katie Hill from Southern California, Gomez, and a few others, and ask meaningful questions, what are called soup questions in the movie Finding Forrester, you will begin to see some Republicans slip away. Keep this in mind. On the day that Richard Nixon resigned and every single member of the House and Senate was against him, 29% of the American public was still with Richard Nixon.
Wow. I just have one more question based on what you said there. First of all, I totally agree. I would be totally fine with no more preening. We could get through these hearings much faster as well. And hopefully some people will take inspiration from what they saw out of some of the questioners that you mentioned. In terms of not overplaying their hand and focusing on what's important, though, I am curious, do you think that they should be focusing on tax evasion? Should they keep up the line on the hush money payments? House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said, I think yesterday, that if he paid off these women, that's not an impeachable offense, so who cares, I guess. What do you think they should focus on?
Well, much as tax is my issue, and I would like to see much more done on tax, it doesn't appear to resonate particularly with the public. I think the important thing to do is to get the public to understand that the Trump Organization is a criminal enterprise. It's always been a criminal enterprise. And showing that at every turn when there was something to do, they were dishonest. They cheated people. They cheated workers, took goods and refused to pay for them. Had all sorts of unsavory connections. I think that's the most important line to pursue. The second one is what appears to be the sale of American secrets by Jared Kushner for immediate political gain and future economic gain. That's a crime for which he could spend the rest of his life in solitary confinement based on some other cases that we've had.
That's true.
And I think this is critically important. He has no business having a national security clearance. We know that Trump and Ivanka, his daughter, both lied that Trump had nothing to do with this, when in fact, Chief of Staff John Kelly and the former White House counsel Don McGahn were so worried they might be prosecuted in the future that they wrote memos to the file saying, we did this under orders from the president.
And that was an amazing revelation that they felt that they should do that. Well, David K. Johnson, it's always a pleasure having you on. Thank you for joining us on the show.
John, glad to be here.
We're going to take a short break. We come back. A number of high-profile Democrats sign on to a pledge to end America's never-ending wars abroad. We'll break that down and tell you who's on the list after this. The stars ignite and a light beam is split between dreams and snares of nice kicks. I'm a product of the stars ignite and a light beam. I read something really depressing earlier this week, and that was that I believe for the first time a soldier was deployed to the Middle East to fight in those wars who was born after 9/11. So we've been engaged in these wars for longer than some of the people fighting them have even been alive. But thankfully, some politicians are taking seriously the need to stop this forever state of war that has become so normalized in America. I mean, we've talked multiple times with Ro Khanna about ending involvement in conflicts like in Yemen. Obviously, Bernie Sanders has been doing great work in this area. But there's also activist groups who are working to push it to the next level. And so there's a group called Common Defense that got a number of different elected Democrats to sign on to a pledge to end these forever wars. Part of the pledge reads, the United States has been in a state of continuous global open-ended military conflict since 2001. Over 2.5 million troops have fought in this forever war in over a dozen countries, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Jordan, Niger, Somalia, and Thailand. It continues, I pledge to the people of the United States of America and to our military community in particular that I will fight to reclaim Congress's constitutional authority to conduct oversight of U.S. foreign policy and independently debate whether to authorize each new use of military force and act to bring the forever war to a responsible and expedient conclusion. So, once again, as in so many other areas that have been driving conversation in the past few months, just questioning the orthodoxy. We have just grown so accustomed to, well, if we're going to change our policy in these countries, it is going to be by shifting by a few hundred or maybe a few thousand the soldiers. We're certainly not going to question that they will be there for the next year or 10 years or 50 years or whatever. And they are working to move us away from that position. The people who have so far signed on to this pledge include Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. You have Ilhan Omar and other freshman representatives, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ro Khanna, and Rashida Tlaib, and also Congressional Progressive Caucus co-chair Mark Pocan, who's not been on the show just yet, but we'll work on that. This is awesome. And also, by the way, in the particular language that they use of Congress not just opposing war, but reasserting that it is the body that is supposed to be setting our policy vis-a-vis military conflict and foreign policy, that is a new thing that hopefully, historically, you have not seen Congress asserting itself in that area, despite the fact that the War Powers Act passed, I think, in 1963. We had just this year the first use of it ever. And we hopefully see that pushed all the way through to Trump's desk as well. And if we start to see that applied to more conflicts, I think that is a great direction for America to move in. I want to read just one more quote. This is from Representative Ilhan Omar, who said, war has been so much a part of the American culture, it's so normalized. We only talk about vets when we talk about the kind of resources they need. We never really have a conversation with vets on what defense should look like and where our engagements are appropriate and when they're not. And the ones we often talk to are people who might have led and might not be the ones getting shot at every day. To that, I know that there are some vets in Congress that are apparently considering signing on to this. I hope that's the case. It seems like it would be an easy sell to people who, unlike me, have actually experienced firsthand the horrors of these forever wars. I hope to see more of that, and not just on the Democratic side. There are any number of vets who are Republicans that should take this seriously and should not feel like it is controversial to say that we don't need to go another 18 years. We don't need another generation serving in past generations' footsteps in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries in the region. With that said, we are going to take one more break. We come back, news from around the globe after this. And now, news from around the world in a segment we call Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in Turkey, Al Jazeera reports that evidence has been collected that implies that murdered Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi's body might have been disposed of by burning it in an outdoor furnace, which is as horrifying and awful as it initially sounds. Turkish authorities monitored the burning of the outdoor furnace from outside the premises as bags believing to be containing his body parts were transferred to the Saudi consul's home after he was killed inside the consulate a few hundred meters away. Al Jazeera interviewed a worker who constructed the furnace who stated it was built according to specifications from the Saudi consul. It had to be deep and withstand temperatures above 1,000 degrees Celsius, hot enough to melt metal. I don't know what the alternative explanation is for why you would need to be able to literally melt metal on the premises. Maybe there's something that they do at consulates that I'm not familiar with. And this is awful. Large quantities of barbecue meat were grilled in the oven after the killing in order to cover up the cremation of the Saudi writer's body, Turkish authorities reported. So, look, at this point, we don't know for sure that this is what happened, but apparently the evidence seems to point in that direction. We do know that months and months after the killing, no body has turned up. The White House is dragging its heels and missing deadlines on when they're supposed to be reporting to Congress on exactly what happened. But as the details are coming out, it's only looking worse and worse. Meanwhile, in... meanwhile, in Germany, a parade was held that had no F's left to give and provided some political commentary that I would define as unambiguous. So this is in Dusseldorf, and one float portrayed a naked Trump as the guardian angel of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman clutching a bloody chainsaw. That was a reference, of course, to the killing we just talked about of Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate. Another float showed Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin ripping up a nuclear arms treaty. And a few weeks before Britain is due to leave the European Union, Theresa May was depicted with a long nose impaling a man wearing a Union Jack hat and carrying briefcases marked economy. Which, this is like a political cartoon if a political cartoon was towering above you and was horrifying. I wish, by the way, we could show you the photos. The AP was being oddly restrictive on showing you it. But look up Dusseldorf Trump chainsaw. It'll come up. It's very graphic, by the way. And I would also say the depiction of Mohammed bin Salman seems maybe a little bit racist. I know he's a murderer and a dictator and all that, but I think we could be a little bit careful with some of the stereotyping in our political floats. Anyway, we don't have stuff like this in the U.S. as far as I know, but it's awesome. It's certainly works of art, and I would like to see more of that. Meanwhile, in... meanwhile, in the UK, we might be witnessing a significant step forward in the treatment of HIV. So, in the history of HIV/AIDS, only a single person is believed to have been cured of the virus. This is Timothy Ray Brown, an American known as the Berlin patient, who had HIV for more than a decade until two stem cell transplants in 2007 and 2008 cleared it from his body. So, that was a decade ago, and there had been only one. Now, we believe there might actually be a second. Like Brown, the new patient had a form of cancer and received a treatment involving chemotherapy to wipe out his immune system and replace it via stem cell transplant with non-malignant donor cells. In both cases, the donor cells also carried an added benefit, a genetic mutation that leads to HIV immunity. In September of 2017, 16 months receiving the transplant, the patient went off his antiretroviral drugs for HIV, yet still tested negative for the virus. So far, he's remained HIV-free after well over a year. So in a time when we can literally count on less than one hand how many people this has worked with, any additional person adding to that list is significant. And for people who are still dealing with this, I understand that HIV and AIDS are two things that we don't really talk about anymore. Obviously, it wasn't talked about enough at the beginning. Then it received some coverage once it started to affect the sort of people that the media actually cares about. And now it's still a thing. It still affects lots of people, new cases and all of that. It's certainly more treatable, but curable is a different matter, and it is very good to see progress moving in that direction as well. Meanwhile, in... meanwhile, around the world in the very near future, a series of climate rallies are going to be held, focusing heavily on the exact same sort of youth-led climate change, but pressing for the need to do something about it. We've had that here. It's going to be happening around the globe, actually. On March 15th, just a couple of weeks away, tens of thousands of high school and middle school students in more than 30 countries plan to skip school to demand that politicians treat the global climate crisis as the emergency it is. Hopefully the leaders of all of these countries will treat them with more respect than Feinstein did not that long ago. Greta Thunberg, a big activist in the area, said, if you think that we should be in school instead, then we suggest that you take our place in the streets, striking from your work. Or better yet, join us so we can speed up the process. That is awesome. She's awesome, by the way. Look up some of what she has done before. Anyway, thank you everybody for joining us. We're going to have so much more a little bit later this week. Big guests coming as well. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.